In this episode, Rob and I are going to be talking about hiring sales consultants, scaling offline acquisition, and keeping data safe in the cloud. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 173. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
Well, I have a couple updates. I've just accepted a little speaking gig in Glasgow, Scotland in June. And so if you're anywhere near Glasgow, there's a conference called Small is Beautiful that is looking at kind of staying small, you know, the bootstrapping ethic. And it's not just going to be software people. It's a lot of makers and even crafts people like who are selling on Etsy and that kind of stuff. So it's June 4th and 5th. It's pretty inexpensive. It's £199. If you're interested in coming, you know, we'd love to hang out. I'll be there for a few days. So smallisb.com. And then the other thing is I want to call out Brennan Dunn's podcast. It's The Business of Freelancing. And episode 13 was had my wife as a guest, and it's called Establishing a Work-Life Balance with Sherry Walling. So if you are interested in hearing more about work-life balance, which I think all of us probably need, you'll hear it there. And then Sherry has also just been confirmed as a speaker for MicroConf Vegas, and she's going to do a full, you know, basically a one-hour session on that kind of stuff, on mindset, on anxiety, depression. Check out the podcast, episode 13. We'll link it up in the show notes. And then hopefully if you're coming to MicroConf, you can hear more about it there.
Oh, I feel absolutely awful. I've been sick for probably about 4 days now. I was all set to like buckle down and actually get a lot of work done this week because I have a down week. So, I mean, we've talked about it before on this podcast where, you know, some of the beauty of having people that you have working for you is that even if you decide to take time off or you get sick, they're going to continue working. And one of the disadvantages of doing everything yourself or doing specific things that have to be done by you is that if you're not doing them, they're just not going to get done. And this week, I just, you know, I've basically been in bed as much as I possibly can just because I felt so awful. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that I had planned on getting done this week has just not gotten done.
Yeah, but like you said, it's good to have folks to keep the machine running while you're, whether it's you being on vacation or being laid up in bed, it's nice to not be doing everything yourself. So I have a couple of book recommendations. I've listened to a few audiobooks in the past couple months, and each of these is kind of applicable to a different scenario. The first one is called Pitch Anything. It's a really well-written book, specifically if you're going to be doing in-person either negotiations or sales or pitching, stuff like that. It's fascinating about the dynamics of how to take the frame of a meeting and how great stories in there and just a great way of thinking about how to come into a room with other people and to take control of the situation if you need to or to give it up if you need to. The next book is called The Year Without Pants. It's by Scott Berkin. I've read pretty much all the books that Scott has written. And this one is about working for WordPress, or frankly, it's working for Automattic, which is the kind of the parent company of WordPress. He worked for a year. There's not a ton of actionable stuff. I think folks in kind of in our circles will have heard a lot because a lot of it is about remote teams and working remotely. And it is a lot of storytelling, project management, building software. I mean, that's kind of a cool thing. But with all that said, there are some interesting characters and there's definitely a nice story arc. And Scott does a good job of communicating it. So if you like stories like maybe the hatching Twitter startup stories of Amazon and that kind of stuff, The Year Without Pants is a good one to add to your collection.
Scott talked at the Business of Software, and there were a couple of really good things that I took away from his talk, which was kind of largely based on his book. And one of which was the way that Automattic hires new employees is that they essentially give them a starter project and they always bring them on as a consultant first. And one of the things that they do is they say, here's access to the repository where you can get all the source code and everything. And here's access to our internal IRC chat. And here's your project. And that's it. Like they don't get code walkthroughs. They don't get anything. And it's like, it's basically up to the person who is being hired to go out and find everything that they need to do, because that's part of the culture there. Like you get things done or you're not going to succeed. And I thought that that, you know, applies really well to a lot of the things that we've talked about in the past, where you have a starter project that you bring people on to kind of vet them as a person who may or may not work out for your team. And then based on how well they perform and the types of things that they do and how they interact with the other team members, that's kind of how you decide to give them, I'll say, an escalated project or do more with them.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the things that I took away from the book. There are a few other tidbits as well, in addition to kind of the fun storyline of just seeing how the year pans out and kind of the insecurities of Scott returning to work after basically being, you know, an author and a speaker for several years and wondering, can I really hack it with kind of the new development culture that's going on.
Today, we're going to be taking some time to answer some listener questions. And the first one comes from Alex. And he says, good morning, Rob and Mike. I'd like to get your expert opinion on something. I just built an online B2B product for a particular industry. I have one customer ready to go live. The product is ready to be introduced to a wider audience. Offline marketing will work better for this particular product and industry. I'm employed full-time and I don't have any sales experience. I was thinking about hiring independent sales consultants or resellers on commission, but I'm not sure where to start. I could probably find people with background in the industry on LinkedIn, but how do I make sure they won't start approaching the same leads? I know it's a pretty common thing to assign salespeople to geographic regions to make sure that they won't step on each other's toes, but in the beginning, if I only have one or two sales agents, I don't want to restrict them to a geographic area. I want them to start selling aggressively nationwide, especially if they already have industry contacts all over. I don't think I can just make independent sales agents or resellers to start using a centralized CRM and put their leads there. Wanted to know what your thoughts were on this. Thanks, Alex.
I kind of feel like he's putting the cart before the horse here. Alex, you're worried about people having overlapping geographical regions when you only have one customer at this point. You said you're not, you know, really a person with any sales experience. In my opinion, the CEO or the founder has to be the first salesperson. And so there's a couple questions that I don't feel like are answered in this email. The first is your product actually saleable yet? Like, does it solve a pain point? Having one customer isn't enough to convince me of that. Until you have personally sold maybe 10 and gotten them signed up, that's when you're going to know, A, what the objections are, when people you're trying to sell it, B, where your product maybe lacks features and where you need to invest more time in development. Because it's not as if you finish the product and you're never going to have to write a line of code. These days, this stuff is not, it's never done, especially for a SaaS product. So I think that you need to spend quite a bit more time upfront getting more people onboarded and getting more people to say yes so that you have a better idea of what that sales process involves. Because then you can take that and bring it to maybe someone you find on LinkedIn or Craigslist or wherever you're going to look, and you're going to have a much better idea of if they're going to be capable of doing this. Because just like when you're non-technical, hiring developers is really hard, if you don't have sales experience, hiring a salesperson is pretty hard because you don't know. You're going to go with the guy who feels most salesy to you, right? The schmoozy guy. And he very well may not be the right person. He or she may not be the right person to sell your software. I'm dubious about the whole idea of trying to, you're basically trying to outsource all of your sales efforts. And as far as I know, I have seen people try this. I've never seen it work, especially when it's full commission, because that, why shouldn't that salesperson just go take a salary gig somewhere, a commissioned sales job with someone who's more proven? I mean, I guess what would really be the benefit? Why should they work with you? Because if you're offering the same thing that some large company is, then other people are going to go with the large company, and only the people who can't hack it there, you know, or who basically aren't very good at sales are going to be the ones that you're going to be able to convince to come work for you. I really question this thought of trying to just outsource sales from day one until you have a better handle on what that sales process looks like and have done it yourself multiple times and have enough experience that you can then vet someone who you're hiring to do it.
I agree with everything that Rob just said. And in addition, you're worrying about problems that you don't even have yet. So you're worrying about trying to keep the sales reps from stepping on each other's toes. And in my experience, that doesn't tend to happen a lot unless you have people who are located almost on top of each other. And I think that if you're finding these people on LinkedIn, chances are really good you're not going to find like five people all in the Boston area to go sell your product. In addition to that, there's a lot of things that Rob said, which you definitely need to pay attention to, which are along the lines of the fact is you don't have a proven sales methodology yet. So my concern would be that you're going to start attracting the dregs of the barrel of the sales reps who are are willing to do just about anything that it takes in order to land a sale. And those things may not necessarily jive with how you want to run the company. They may not even be true. I mean, you may end up with people who are buying a product that the sales reps made all these promises about, and the product just isn't going to be able to deliver. You know, going back to what the book that Rob talked about earlier, you know, to the Pitch Anything book, pick up a copy of that, pick up a couple of different books on how to do sales and do it yourself. You have to do this yourself at least a couple of times. You can't just outsource things that you don't like if you don't understand them, because there are inevitably going to be things that slip through the cracks and you're not going to know how to handle them because you've never done it before. So Alex, thanks for the question. Our next email comes in from Carl Soderman, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I really enjoy listening to your podcast. You've given me so many tips that are valuable for me while starting up Ingredient Matcher. You've been talking so much about mastermind groups that I'd really like to have one. So I started this meetup group in Stockholm, and we'll link to this in the show notes, but it's at meetup.com/Stockholm-micropreneurs. So if anyone out there listening is in Stockholm or in the nearby vicinity, definitely go check out that meetup group. I think that we're going to be putting something together to kind of help people coordinate between different meetup groups and different people getting together at different places of the world. We don't have anything set up just yet, but that is something that we are working on. So kind of stay tuned, listen to the podcast, check the podcast website at startupsfortherestofus.com. We're going to be putting together a mailing list out there in a little while. People are going to be able to get more information about not just those meetups, but some other things that we're working on in terms of the micropreneur community. So thanks, Carl. Our next email comes from Andrew, and he says, "Hi, guys. Just wondering if you have any recommendations regarding organizing your emails, such as creating tasks from email, etc. I seem to recall that you talked about this in one of your podcasts, but I can't remember which one it was. Thanks, Andrew."
The best way that I found is to use Trello, and then you get an email address that's unique to a specific Trello board. And from within Gmail, if I want to add something, I can just forward it. Even from my phone is where I typically do this. And I'll just forward things off to that address. I have it as my Trello contact in Gmail. And then it appears at the top of my Trello board. And the next time I go in, I can then reorder it and work on it. It's not ideal. As I've said in the past, I think that having a way to reorder emails within Gmail and then add additional tasks so that it really does become a to-do list in your inbox, that's how I would prefer to do it. But this way of kind of some of the emails into Trello is the best approach that I've found thus far.
I think part of the answer to this question depends on what tools you're comfortable with using and what tools you already use. So I use a combination of, I don't know, half a dozen things. So I use Pipedrive, I use Trello, I use Evernote, and then I also use Fogbugs, and I also have a Pivotal Tracker account. So depending on what you're doing, it's going to dictate what you do with those inbound emails. Rob's got a great idea there with setting up the different email aliases. You can do the same thing with Basecamp, but that's another tool that I use. And all of those things, it depends a lot on your specific workflow of how you work. I think the one thing I would probably mention is that as you're getting these things into your mailbox that need to be taken care of, what I would do is I would pull them out of your mailbox, put them in that other location, whether it's, you know, another tool, whether it's Trello or Basecamp or what have you, and then get rid of it from your mailbox. So that way you use your mailbox as things that you're working on right this second that you need to kind of actively deal with, and anything that doesn't need to be there, just archive it or delete it or get rid of it. I use Gmail. I know that Rob does as well, but the search capabilities there are phenomenal. So being able to pull up your email from several years ago is very easy to do. So Andrew, hopefully that helps. Our next question comes in from Igor, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I'm a graduate student and a longtime listener from Helsinki, Finland. I'm interested in applying the problem or pain identification process to find an idea for a B2B SaaS app, but I'd like to know your opinion on an issue I've been researching heavily for a long time. Here's my question. Can you really scale customer acquisition for an online app with an offline market or a vertical niche as its target audience? Examples would be a small hotel or hostel owners or photographers. A few sources say it's not feasible since you would need to do some form of high-touch selling, but that wouldn't be justified by the low price points that SMBs are comfortable with. For example, Jason Lemkin writes that customer acquisition costs have to be almost zero if one targets very small businesses. But I'm curious whether things would be different if the target businesses have relatively few decision makers and the app is an aspirin type product. This way, even if one-on-one sales calls would be necessary, the number of sales per rep or founder might be higher than the traditional 8 to 10 closed deals per month estimate for enterprise-grade products. Thanks, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your perspectives."
I think you've stumbled upon a big catch-22 of trying to sell to offline audiences who are also price sensitive. Because if that's the case, then it is really, really hard to scale up customer acquisition. But it's if they're either online and price sensitive or they're offline and not price sensitive where this approach can obviously work. And I would make one correction. Igor mentions photographers, and photographers are actually online. I know a number of people who make a lot of money selling software and services and other things to photographers, and that it's the marketing is solely done online. You know, I haven't done this, and I don't know of anyone who has truly done an offline product and done offline sales on a low price point product, but the math's just not going to work out. The thing that I've noticed is if you're going to have to do high touch sales and make in-person sales calls, I think your minimum price point has to be low four figures if it's a one-time sale, and it has to be low three figures if it's a monthly recurring product. And that would be my rule of thumb. If you think you're going to be able to, you know, charge $29 a month and actually have in-person people going around selling, the economics of that just don't work out. But the question of can one scale customer acquisition for an online app with an offline market, the answer to that is absolutely. It's once you get the low price point piece integrated that becomes a real problem. Now, with all that said, Gail Goodman from Constant Contact did a talk at Business of Software a couple years ago, and their price point is $39 a month, and they did scale it offline, but they did it in kind of a clever way, and they also had funding. They had a ton of money to kind of back it up. They got sales reps out holding like meetings and training sessions and marketing of meetup groups and all kinds of stuff, and they set up this massive infrastructure that you are going to, as an individual without funding, are going to have a real tough time doing if not, you know, being able not to do it at all, frankly. So I think in general, the answer to your question is probably not, unless you already have an in, or, you know, you can always do outbound marketing that's not in person, right? So if you have small hotels or hostels, you can do lead gen using things like direct mail or one-on-one outbound email, that kind of stuff. But all that's going to require experimentation to see if it works in the niche.
The question itself is, yes, it can definitely be done. Of course, the follow-up question to that is, well, how much money do you have to actually make this happen? Because if you don't have the money to make it happen, and I think you brought up an excellent point with Constant Contact, is that they were funded. So they had the money to be able to do that kind of thing. And they were doing it early on when it was, I would say, probably more cost effective to do it that way, because they could probably do a combination of offline and online marketing to help acquire some of their customers. And it back then, I mean, Google AdWords was still very early on. Online advertising was dirt cheap, and the cost of acquisition for those customers was probably economical at that time, especially for the online market. But in going offline, it's labor intensive. You got to be able to schedule things. You have to be able to get enough people there to any given meeting so that you are able to close enough deals that it is worth the time and labor investment. And that really takes funding. I mean, you have to have some sort of, you know, either revenue or cash on hand or something in order to be able to make ends meet while you're doing that, because it's going to be a long, slow slog in order to get those people and to achieve any sort of critical mass. And I don't know as you can do it without some sort of funding. So Igor, thanks for the question. Our next one comes from Carl, and he says, "Hi guys, what's up? I love the show. I run a small SaaS business called Clinic Metrics, and I launched it this year. I need an accountant. Question for you is it important for your accountant to be local? If you have a referral, I'd love one. If not, how did you find yours? Thanks."
This depends on two things. Number one, are you comfortable with your accountant not being local? And number two, is your accountant able to work with remote people? And if the answer to both of those is yes, then I don't think you need your accountant to be local. I have had remote accountants for several years. Currently, I have one who is local, but if I moved away, I probably would not switch. But he happens to be really good at email, and he's, you know, a little bit of a techie guy. Same thing with my bookkeeper. He lives across the country. All I've ever done is a video Skype or two. Everything else is via email. Now, but if you're working with an old school accountant who's all paper and pencil and wants to talk on the phone or meet in person every time, then obviously you're not going to want to hire them. These days, I think you can find both accountants and bookkeepers who should be able to work remote without an issue. And in fact, that opens you up to basically being able to find the best person for the job rather than trying to find the best person for the job within your city. The way that I have found mine with the accountant, I found based on a referral, just talking to some local entrepreneurs, figuring out who is startup friendly, who knows SaaS, who knows software, that kind of stuff, and then went and talked to a couple of those people. But if you're going to do your book specifically through Xero, I would actually recommend that you go to Xero's website, and there is a Xero providers area where there's a bunch of certified providers. And that's where I found my bookkeeper, was through them. And so it sounds to me like you may want a bookkeeper rather than an accountant, because then a bookkeeper is going to do it a month, you know, on a monthly basis, and then the accountant would file the taxes at the end of the year. I think you may want to start with a bookkeeper. That's probably going to save you more time on a recurring basis. And for that, I would definitely go to Xero and look for through those certified folks, and then just pick one that you think looks good and give them a shot.
There is a difference between a bookkeeper and an accountant. The accountant just files your taxes at the end of the year. At least that's what I use mine for. And then I have a bookkeeper who, you know, balances the budget, pays all the bills, and then makes sure that all the financial stuff is in order at the end of the year for the CPA. And I do that for two reasons. One is because a bookkeeper is significantly cheaper than having an accountant do it. And then the second reason is that you essentially have a double check at the end of the year, because you've got your bookkeeper doing all the books, and then at the end of the year, your accountant kind of goes over everything to make sure that nothing's been done that's, you know, too far out of whack, and is able to kind of point you in different directions where any mistakes might have been made. So those are the differences between them. But as Rob said, I mean, if you're going to be using Xero, which Carl had mentioned that in the PS, is that Xero does have a dedicated section where you can hire bookkeepers who are familiar with Xero. Now, that said, Xero is not that complicated. My bookkeeper actually picked it up and was able to learn how to use Xero because she was familiar with other things. She started out with QuickBooks. She's used Less Accounting for one of my businesses. And she's also familiar with Outright. So between those things, I mean, the basic concepts are fundamentally the same. It's just a matter of how do you do the specific things that she wants to do. And with Xero, they have tons and tons of video tutorials. So just about anything that you need to know how to do, there's probably a video for it. So you can go in there and, worst case scenario, just contact their support and ask them questions.
Yeah, I wasn't saying he should go to Xero certified because those people know Xero better than anyone else. It's just a nice pool of reasonably competent bookkeepers to start with. I mean, I think you could also go to Odesk or Elance and these other places where I have, you know, looked for bookkeepers there as well. But the Xero pool just seemed to be pretty competent people. I talked to a couple of them, and any one of them would have worked for me.
So our next question comes in from Elliot Sykes. He left us a voicemail. Here it is.
Hi Rob, hi Mike. My name's Elliot Sykes, and I'd like to pick your collective brain about guest blogging. In the last week or so, Matt Cutts announced that guest blogging as a promotional tool is on Google's spam team's hit list. Given this, what's your advice for people thinking about guest blogging as one of the ways to promote their projects? And does this change anything for the way you're going to handle guest writers on your own sites? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, and thanks for continuing to make such a great show week after week for all us bootstrappers. Bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Elliot. It's nice to hear from you after seeing your name online over these years. So Matt Cutts, who is the Google Spam Teams leader, talked about guest blogging. Now, he also talked about infographics 6 months ago. And basically, they're going to go after anything that they see people overdoing and exploiting. And so I think the question of, you know, how I'm going to handle it is, until I see backlash, I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing, because I'm not doing spammy guest posting and I'm not doing spammy infographics. I think that when you get to the point where you're just doing them at a high volume, and it's obvious there's no, like, social sharing is an indicator they're probably going to look at, there's going to be these signals that make these things look legitimate, and signals that make things, or it's usually lack of signal that makes these things look less legitimate and more spammy. So it's always hard to tell to see how they're going to tune the algorithm. I'm not that worried about it. I think if it was my number one way of getting the word out, then yes, I'd be seriously looking at what I'm doing, because if I had, let's say you have 50 guest posts out there on a bunch of blogs, that might be a problem, but I don't think it's just surely the number of them. I think it's going to be these patterns that they recognize. And so I think if you really are handcrafting good quality blogs, whether you're blog posts, whether you're doing it yourself, or whether you're hiring someone to do it, and you really are dealing one-on-one with reputable blogs that, you know, are actually have an audience and things are actually being shared, and you're actually publishing them on these reputable blogs, I really don't see how they can crack down on that. How do they not just crack down on kind of all links everywhere? I think what they're going after is the people when they have, you know, 1,000 guest blog posts, and a lot of them are on these really crappy, almost link farms. I mean, there's basically these link blogs where people can pay to guest post on. And surely if you're doing that, I would avoid it. But again, if you're doing kind of the handcrafted approach to it, my gut feeling is that that's going to be okay for the foreseeable future. And just like I said, with infographics, they talked about cracking down on that. I don't know if that ever happened, because I haven't seen anyone that's really gotten hit by that. But I also typically see people doing pretty non-spammy infographics as well.
Well, I think that anytime Google issues one of these statements, and the collective internet freaks out when this kind of stuff comes out, because they're like, oh my God, we can't do this anymore. What are we going to do for our marketing? And if you go back and you actually look at Matt Cutts' blog, he says flat out on there, there are still many, and I'll quote him here, there are still many good reasons to do some guest blogging. Those reasons existed way before Google, and they'll continue into the future. And there are absolutely some fantastic, high quality guest bloggers out there. I've changed the title of this post to make it clear that I'm talking about guest blogging for search engine optimization purposes. I'm also not talking about multi-author blogs. High-quality multi-author blogs like Boing Boing have been around since the beginning of the web, and they can be compelling, wonderful, and useful. I just want to highlight that a bunch of low-quality or spam sites have latched on to guest blogging as their link-building strategy, and we see a lot more spammy attempts to do guest blogging. Because of that, I'd recommend skepticism, or at least caution, when someone reaches out and offers you a guest blog article. So based on that, it's not that they're looking at this and saying, well, guest blogging is bad, and that's just very black and white. What they're really doing is they're really coming out and saying, look, if you're doing these things where you are essentially spamming the internet with content, we will find out about it, and we will shut you down. It's not that they're going after the people who are doing it legitimately for exposure or branding or increasing their community size. That's not what they're after. They're after for the people who are trying to exploit the system. And that's really the way that Google has always been. They've always been going after those people who are trying to exploit the rules and the loopholes. And I don't think that this is any different than it has been in the past. So Elliot, hope that clarifies a few things on what Matt Cutts' announcement means. Our last question comes in from Zach, and he says, thanks for your wonderful podcast, which is full of pragmatic gems. I'm now working to start a SaaS app. I've spoken to a business owner about my idea, and he questioned how I can ensure that his company's data is safe in the cloud and that no one has access to it. He's worried about leaking his company's strategic information to others. He's more comfortable installing my app on his server rather than storing the data in the cloud. How should I go about convincing him?
My first thought is don't convince him that he's probably not a good fit or SaaS apps, and that there are a ton of other people out there who, if you truly do solve a pain point for them, are going to be fine putting their data in the cloud. Second thought is, if you go to 10 other customers or potential customers and they all have the same objection, then you really are going to need to figure out how to get around it, or you're in a bad market right now and that you need to find a market that is more willing to go online, or you need to wait these guys out, because over time, everyone is going to move to the cloud. I mean, I think it's inevitable. And it's just a matter of, you know, do you have the kind of the time and the money to wait them out so that they are willing to go to the cloud? Or are you going to have to convince each one of them to do it? And are you willing to do that? I think convincing someone their data is safe in the cloud is, I mean, frankly, I would probably Google this exact topic and look at what are the three elements of it. There's going to be security of data from like a technical perspective. There's going to be securing the data at the server side. There's securing it from hackers. There's a bunch of stuff like that. And I think that it's probably not something you're going to get in a 2-minute podcast answer, but it's going to be something that you're going to have to research. I think his inclination, he'd rather install it on his own server than storing the data in the cloud. I would encourage you that if you want to start a SaaS app, not even to entertain that idea in the least. These days, trying to build an installable version of your web app is frankly more trouble than it's worth, unless you're in a specific niche where you're going to need that specifically. If you do need that, then you need to make a choice. And it's like, are you going to be downloadable web installable software, or are you going to be SaaS? But as a single founder, which I'm assuming you are, I would not try to do both.
I think when you run into these types of people, you almost have to dig a little bit to find out what the underlying issue is. Is it really that they're not comfortable putting their data in the cloud, or is it that they are not really aware of the dangers that they currently face, or do they just not want to pay a monthly subscription fee for it? So definitely hammer those out. But at the end of the day, if they're not necessarily educated about the risks that they face today, I mean, what's to prevent one of their employees who on their way out going to the file server, grabbing everything, and then just emailing it out to everybody? Do they have software in place to stop that? Do they have technical controls? Are they actively checking for that kind of thing? My guess as an answer to all those questions is no, they don't. So realistically, they face that today. he's using it as a way to essentially skirt the issue and in some ways say no. So you need to kind of dig a little bit and find out, is that really the problem for him? Is he really actually concerned about it, or is there something else and he's just throwing that up as kind of a smokescreen to say, I'm not really interested in doing that because all of my other software is all on my servers.
Yeah, I would agree with that sentiment. Now, I could also see that let's say you provide him with a ton of information and say, all right, these are the standards of Salesforce and of, you know, the big Fortune 500 SaaS businesses, and this is what everybody does. And you can show him all the proof that you do exactly that, and you have all these audits in place, and you have all this checking, that it's still not going to convince him. So it's kind of a decision you have to make for yourself and figure out that if you really do want to convince this one individual, or if you want to move on and find someone who's maybe more open to SaaS software.
I think my advice in this particular case would be move on and find somebody else, because you're essentially looking for the path of least resistance to success. I mean, you don't want to make things harder for yourself than they have to be. And, you know, trying to convince somebody who's not real keen on the idea to begin with is probably not in your best interest. You're better off finding people who experience that pain, who are comfortable with putting their data in the cloud, and leveraging those people as kind of your beachhead into the market in order to expand and get other customers on board. And then in the future, when you're better established, you have money coming in and revenue, you can start dedicating time more towards educating people about why their data is going to be safe in the cloud with you versus trying to convince person after person that it may not necessarily be the best fit for your software. The second question that Zach has is, have you ever seen any non-US companies successfully operate SaaS businesses targeting US customers? I'm based in Singapore and plan to offer my SaaS app to US customers. So in terms of non-US companies, one that comes to mind is Xero. It's the accounting software, which we briefly touched on earlier in this episode. It's Xero. And I actually have two different businesses with all of my accounting and financial information in there. So it depends on the person, and it depends on the person you're marketing to and what sorts of data that they're putting in there. Now, with mine, I'm putting in financial information, and they're able to pull my accounts and see how much money I have and how much I owe. But it doesn't necessarily have the ability to issue checks on my behalf, for example. It's not like it's banking. It's not like they have the ability right now to send money out of my accounts. Now, it is sensitive data, theoretically, but I'm comfortable enough with all of the things that they've done. They are probably keeping it securely. But again, that's a mentality thing. It's not necessarily going to apply across the board. You're really going to have to find the customers who are comfortable with that sort of arrangement. And I think at that point, it doesn't necessarily matter where you are based. Rather, you know, are you offering a good service that's valuable that people are going to subscribe to and be interested in?
I think some other companies that are overseas that do a really good job are Atlassian. Balsamic is in Italy, and they have a lot of customers all around the world. Campaign Monitor is in Australia. 99designs, while not a SaaS app, is also in Australia. And there are quite a few. So BigCommerce is another one. I think that this is less of an issue than you might think. I think especially if you don't call it out, you know, prominently, like we are the Singapore-based SaaS app. I mean, you can have it on your about page for sure. But when I go to look for SaaS, I'm much less concerned. Unless you're dealing with Fortune 500 companies that are going to move slowly and have a bunch of objections anyways, I think you're going to be okay with being located overseas. I think that's becoming less and less important over time. And you can even look at Patrick McKenzie doing appointment reminder from Japan. He has a lot of US-based customers.
So Zach, I hope that answers both of your questions.
If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690. Or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. You can find a full transcript of this episode at startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.